Good morning and welcome to Up to Date. Steve Kraske is away. I'm Brian Ellison. It's 1970, Oxford, North Carolina, and there is a murder. Not just any murder. A black man is killed by white men in broad daylight with many witnesses. What follows is a story of tensions erupting into violence, justice delayed and denied, and a generation beset with change and soul-searching that continues into this day. Today on Up to Date, we're talking about that incident, about the effects that it had on the white and black communities of that small town, and what it all says about the history of American race relations and civil rights, and what it says for the world today. Dr. Timothy Tyson is the author of Blood Done Sign My Name, the book that tells his story and the story of his family. He's joining us today along with his father, the Reverend Vernon Tyson, and his sister, Boo Tyson. They're all here with us this morning on Up to Date, and later we'll also be joined by Mary D. Williams, who teaches with Dr. Tyson at Duke, and will be sharing with us a little more of their presentation that they share around the country. Good morning and welcome to all of you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Good morning.
We should mention, by the way, that they're speaking tonight at St. Paul School of Theology. The dinner portion of that event is filled to capacity, but everyone's welcome to the event that starts at 7 o'clock, the lecture and presentation part of the evening. So, Tim Tyson, the story that you tell in this book, which took place in Oxford, North Carolina long ago, begins with just a picture of this small town. Tell us about Oxford, North Carolina.
Oxford's a little tobacco market town, about 40 miles north of Durham, near the Virginia line. It's a county seat town. We moved there in 1966 in the height of the civil rights era. And my father, Vernon Tyson, was a Methodist minister. Vernon, who's here with us, and a friend of mine that I played with every day came up in our yard and said, "Daddy and Roger and them shot him a nigger." Those were his words. And then Boo, my sister, and I, Boo, who's with us this morning also, walked down to the corner and we saw armed men all over the front porch of the Teal house. And some of them wearing the hoods and robes of the Ku Klux Klan. This is how the civil rights movement came to Oxford. We had protests that came up out of First Baptist Church on Sunday afternoon. We had other kinds of protests that were hatched in the wee hours at McCoy's Pool Hall involving gasoline bombs. So we had much of Oxford destroyed in the downtown in rioting and in a wave of arson. We had demonstrations and marches and the emergence of Ben Chavis, who was a local black man, who later became the executive director of the NAACP and worked the Million Man March. So this is kind of the messy and complicated not story of the movement, not so much the kind of respectable and confection, the comforting fiction of the movement as, you know, strictly a nonviolent call on America's conscience that America answered, but instead a kind of a mixed and messy confrontation between our past and our future in which we never quite resolved.
Yeah. And so Vernon Tyson, tell us. Take us back. Take us back to 1966 when you first arrive in this little town. I think it's hard to imagine for folks today what you encountered. It says that you wrote in your diary when you first got there that this was a difficult congregation to serve and that you never felt like you quite fit in.
It was a little county seat town with a power structure around the courthouse, and the ruts were deep. It was a little like driving an old-fashioned car, and you were in the rut, and you'd turn, but the wheels wouldn't get out of the ruts. Mm-hmm. But they were lovely people, wonderful people, salt-of-the-earth people, but nevertheless not open to change all that much.
Particularly when the change involved race relations.
Of course. We'd had 250 years of slavery and 100 years of Jim Crow, and it was just... And we We were in a time of change. The Supreme Court said to do it with all deliberate speed, and we were doing with all deliberate slowness.
Yeah. And of course, that's one of the things that's striking about this story, Tim, is that it occurs in 1970, not at 1964 when the Civil Rights Act is passed, not in the 50s when Brown versus Board of Education is being argued. How is this still happening in 1970 in Oxford?
Actually, 1970 was probably the most violent time in American history after Reconstruction. Maybe mm-hmm. you'd have to say that in 1919, when we had a wave of violence in pretty much all the cities in the United States after World War I, that might have been worse. But 1970, you've got rioting everywhere. This is 2 years. Martin Luther King is dead. And furthermore, he had not been popular when he was alive. Even in the black community, nonviolence was a dead issue. Very few people believed in that. That seemed to have been answered with the assassination. You had the Weather Underground blowing up the police station in New York City and San Francisco and setting off a bomb in the United States Capitol. You had 1.5 million people in the streets protesting the invasion of Cambodia, President Nixon's expansion of the Vietnam War. You had the Black Panthers the Black Power movement. So it's we're not very it's the idea that actually that was I could have written this book about practically any city and town in America.
Right.
You know, if I say Detroit riot, if I don't give a year, you don't even know which one I'm talking mm-hmm. about. Los Angeles, mm-hmm. how many times in the 20th century has Los Angeles burst into bloody violence and arson? How many – Cincinnati just a couple of years ago. Miami, take your pick really. I mean Baltimore – this is not really an unusual story at all.
Yeah, Oxford was not an unusually backward or unique town in the situations that it encountered.
No. The same week you have the same week this happens, you have Augusta, Georgia catch on fire, and Governor Lester Maddox sends in the troopers and gives them live ammunition and says shoot to kill,
mm-hmm.
and they killed 6 people and wounded dozens of others, and much of Augusta, Georgia is on fire. It's the same week. I could go on.
Sure.
You know, there are troops in the White House at one point, you know.
Right. Yeah. Protecting. Right. I was struck by one of the comments when you went back to the town to do a lot of the research for this book, and you talked to the man who had been mayor at the time, and he tells you that – and I his quote really grabbed me. He said, "I don't think there was any hostility between the races. It was just an accepted way of life," he says. And I guess I'm curious how that could not have seemed cognitively dissonant even then.
It's just North Carolina is very American that way, because North Carolina likes to think of itself as something not like Mississippi, maybe not like a place where moderation met reasonableness and mm-hmm. Progress was the order of the day. And yet we actually had violent upheavals all over the state. And so people were talking about this as being a progressive kind of community, and the building was on fire.
Yeah.
Like that was just kind of normal.
Now, Boo, how old were you if I may ask this question in 1970?
I was 8.
You were 8 years old.
Yes.
What do you remember about this time and place as a child?
I remember going to the corner with Tim. Mm-hmm. I remember how normal in some ways a lot of the men on the porch and guns look. They look like hunters.
Mm.
There were a couple of people in robes. But what was interesting to me is that we had that dissonance as well, that we were being taught that God loved all people. We were all created equal. And yet we were sort of living in the midst of a race riot all around us.
Yeah.
And it was, as a child, sort of hard to figure out, although I also was 8 years old, and I don't know that I wasn't thinking about any kind of big historical significance, but I knew that my town, something was going on, and the Teals lived right down the street from us. I mean, really, just a half block.
And the Teals, the family that committed
the murder. And so and we were kind of scared of them, at least I was, even before this happened. They were known to be kind of mean.
Mm-hmm.
in the neighborhood. But this incident, I mean, where they're on the porch and they have guns, and our parents the next day told, I mean, we, at some point we were told to walk a different way to school. And being the good Tyson children that we are, we didn't do that. We walked right by there.
You're admitting this in front of your father.
Shame on you, boo.
That's right. Yeah. Enough times passed, I think.
Right.
So anyway, I do remember it, but I don't – it's looking back on it now that I see how significant it was that we were growing up right in the midst of all this.
We're listening to Tim Tyson and Vernon Tyson and Boo Tyson, Vernon, the father of Tim and Boo, and them all of them in the book Blood Done Sign My Name that Tim wrote. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Let's dig a little deeper into the incident you described a moment ago, Tim, which you opened the book with and which is at the very center of the story. But, of course, the book is about much more than just the incident. But it is a murder that takes place of a man named Henry Merrow, Jr. Who was he?
Henry Merrow was a 23-year-old Army veteran just home in 1970. There were a lot – he did not actually go to Vietnam, but there were a lot of black – he's a Vietnam-era veteran, and there were a lot of black Vietnam veterans in town. One of them, Eddie McCoy. Mr. McCoy became my sort of guide and source and was really responsible for my being able to interview the people who had burned much of downtown Oxford and get their story, which rarely is told. I was able to get through my own – resources was able to get Mr. Teal, who's really responsible for the murder, to explain this from his point of view. So in some ways, I think one of the strengths of the good fortune that I've had with the book was that I was able to get some voices into the mix that we often don't hear from.
And what Mr. Teal, who is, well, not who is just alleged, who it's generally agreed, brutally beat and then shot this young man. What does he say about this incident now?
His exact words, that nigger committed suicide coming in my store wanting to four-letter word my daughter-in-law. It was clearly something that he was accustomed to saying the whole sentence. I mean.
Yes, yes.
And that was his – he also felt that he was a victim, that this had been – had sort of ruined his life, and that all the friends who had rallied around him because he was the symbol of white resistance to school integration, which was going to happen in the fall. This is in May. In September, we're going to have full-blown school integration. It's 17 years after Brown versus Board, but we still haven't obeyed the federal law, and we're going to in September, and people are tense about that. And in many ways, that's what this is about. Henry Merrow had walked into the Teal store, which is in the black community, and there was an exchange. He was perceived as having said something flirtatious or sexual to a white woman, which is not clear at all that that's what happened.
Right.
But scuffle breaks out, and he takes off running, and he's shot from behind a couple of hundred feet off the property, running as fast as he can. They shoot him in the buttocks with a shotgun, then go over and break a shotgun stock over his head, massively fracturing his skull, and then shoot him between the eyes like you or I would kill a snake. Just on his back and helpless.
So no one is arrested for this crime, at least not right away.
Not right away. There's a Billy Watkins, who's the state legislator and the most powerful attorney in town, became their lawyer, and he kept them out of jail a couple of days. They had time to sort of get their story together. And were not prosecuted very vigorously. But that was because people were upset, because the whole country was in turmoil about race and the meaning of nation and freedom and what the role of African Americans were going to be in this society. The country was in this uproar, and then in this little town, school integration had raised tensions to a point where suddenly the courthouse crowd and the country club folks raised money and rallied around the Teals as a way of protesting integration and the changing of this sort of fixed system of race relations toward equal citizenship. And so that was at the heart of things. And Mr. Teal felt in retrospect, you know, when I interviewed him in 1982, he felt that he was the victim, that he had stood up for white supremacy, really, and for the and then had been deserted. But afterwards, the better folks who had funded his defense didn't really want anything to do with him and were ashamed of,
right.
of what
he had
happened.
To sell his businesses and everything, right? He kind of lost his his place in the community.
Yeah, he did.
He was acquitted at trial, an all-white jury. And did he ever express, even to you all these years later, any remorse, any acknowledgement that what he had done was a bad thing?
No. He was sorry it had happened because it had been so bad for him. But so he clearly regretted it in that sense. But, you know, in many ways, the people who benefited from that system were not really the Teals of the world, but instead the people who were in power in the town and the respectable folk. And in many ways, he's right in that it wasn't him. It wasn't just that was really somebody losing their temper out of fear, out of white supremacy, out of strong emotion, having to do with the what was happening in the whole country. So that's a moment. But if you look at the, for example, who owned everything, and who does own everything now, then you're really who benefited from the violence. That was the social structure that had to be toppled in order to have equal citizenship. We often sort of think that somehow this was won in court or was legislation, but there was no Civil Rights Act in downtown Oxford until somebody went in there and got kicked and got brutalized and got kicked. You know, the Civil Rights Act depended on, I mean, it always depends on what happens on the ground locally.
Right.
So, I mean, the Civil Rights Act of 1875 would have been perfectly satisfactory if it were abided
by. If it were actually enforced,
So, to
begin to get to that then, so after the crime, after the riots in the town, after the trial where there's an acquittal sort of unthinkably, just the perpetrators are let off scot-free. Vernon Tyson, how do you get involved in this story? You're the pastor of the mostly white or all-white Methodist church in town. How does this become your story too?
Well, this happened in the month of May, and I was already scheduled to be moved in June. That's the way Methodist systems work. So I wasn't involved in that particular story except to try to have some peace. I did go to Henry Merrow's funeral along with my friend Thad Stem, and we were the two white people at this funeral where there were lots of people. And we were hoping just to sort of get the body in the ground and go home peaceably. But a man crawled up on the clay, a mound of clay at the cemetery, and he had a cloak on and an African-looking garb. And he said after the benediction, "Hold on, don't y'all go anywhere. We got to talk, and we got to march." And I thought, this place is just going to blow up. And so he invited the crowd to go down and visit the Confederate soldier downtown, the statue of the soldier. And Thad and I went about two blocks, and when we came to our house, I said, "Thad, I'm not prepared to go." And he said, "Neither am I. Let's have some soup and sandwich in my kitchen." And so we bowed out of that.
You had already had some difficulties in your own congregation because you had taken some steps to bring the races together.
I had a couple of things. One is I'd invited a black man to come and preach in our church, which seems pretty normal this kind of time of year, but it wasn't normal then. And I'd also led the integrated ministers to have a memorial service for Dr. Martin Luther King on Sunday afternoon after he had been killed.
And that was not well received by your whole congregation.
No. We were going to announce it. We planned it on Saturday and going to announce it at 11 o'clock services. But the word had gotten out, and when I got to my study Sunday morning, my office was full of folks who were committed not to let that happen. And so we had a kind of confrontation of people I knew and who knew me very well. Mm-hmm. And they said, you can't do that here. This is our church. And I said, I thought this was God's church. And they said, but you can't do it here. And I said, I think I can. Here's the discipline of our church. And it says that the pastor can determine the number and the nature of the services held in the sanctuary. And as of today, I am the pastor, and that's what we are going to do tomorrow.
Well, and Tim, you said that when you went back as an older child, you would go back, and it was there that you learned people referred to your father as the preacher they ran out of town.
Yeah. That was that very summer, because you know we moved in June, and as Methodist ministers' families do, and I sort of stayed. I had friends who had a farm that was just down the road from where the murder had occurred. And that was sort of my summer camp growing up. I stayed on the farm and we rode horses and fished and shot guns and all kinds of things that you didn't get to do in town. But the man that I was living with, the father in the family, had pulled me aside and said, you know, I just want you to know that I don't go to church anymore. Hmm. You know, after what happened to your daddy, I told him they could ask him to leave if they wanted to, but if they did, I would never set foot in that church again. So I just wanted you to know why on Sunday morning, Joy will take y'all to church, but I don't go.
Wow.
And that took me aback. And, you know, I went to the pool and a couple of people, other kids sort of teased me a little bit about it. It made me really mad because, you know, when you're 11, you move and your whole world is uprooted. You know, you don't really... everything changes, it was a big deal to me, and I also wanted to get to the bottom of why all the craziness. Because the truth is, we moved to Wilmington, which was much more intense, actually. I mean, well, this is like a garden party compared to what happened in
frying
Wilmington.
Frying pan into the fire.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes. And that, in some ways, I think our experience and what happened to us in Oxford, we look back at it through Wilmington in many ways because Oxford was what started it, but things were
They were already on fire.
They were much more intense, what happened in Wilmington.
Definitely.
Yeah, we're talking with the Tyson family about Blood Done Signed My Name and the events of Oxford, North Carolina, and beyond in 1970. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also send us email at update@kcur.org. Melissa from Overland Park writes that she agrees with Tim about the violent years. Civil rights hit my life in 1968, she says. One night it took her father 4 years to get home from his job at the Pentagon because of, I'm sorry, 4 hours to get home from his job at the Pentagon because of rioting in D.C. Women up and down the block were alternately waiting on the driveway or phoning friends. On a normal night, it was a 20-minute drive. He walked in the door and said, "Damn it, we're moving to Nebraska." And we did. About a week later, her mother drove them to see the burned blocks so they wouldn't forget that their world needed fixing. And there's stories like that all around, I'm sure. I want to move in before we go to our break. I want to start moving back to something you alluded to earlier, where you say, Tim, that this reveals is that the civil rights movement and the journey towards civil rights in the United States is not as clean and pristine as we sometimes make it out to be. How does this incident and what happened with your family in North Carolina sort of reveal the underside, if you will, of this journey toward equality?
In some ways, this is a very American story. You have a young African American man who's killed. You have police malfeasance and judicial indifference. You have rioting that involves the destruction of business, of white-owned business property. You know, this is a very that story is still happening. It's somebody gets killed by the police, and you know there's a response that's not adequate. there's a perceived injustice. Somebody is, you know, killed on camera, and yet the murderers go free, and then you have massive rioting. This happens; it still happens every few years. And when you create pools of social misery anywhere from Beirut to Baltimore, they will ignite at some point. Dr. King said, "A riot is the language of the unheard." If we are indifferent to people's welfare and they feel that the nation holds them in contempt, then they will return that feeling predictably, and we will have this kind of turmoil.
Well, let's continue the conversation in a few minutes about how this turmoil continues to play itself out, even in today's society, maybe on issues of race, maybe on other issues as well. We'll continue our conversation with Tim Tyson, the author of Blood Done Sign My Name, as well as his father Vernon and his sister Boo. We'll also hear from Mary Williams, who not only teaches with Tim Tyson, but is also a singer and who joins in presentations on these subjects, and we'll share a little of that with us after the break. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation yesterday with cave diver Kenny Broad, you'll find that, plus our talk about the NAIA basketball tournament, on kcur.org. Tomorrow, a conversation with renowned celebrity photographer and KC native son Greg Gorman, plus some Irish rock music to kick off your weekend. But today, Blood Done Sign My Name.
I know the blood done sign my name. I know the blood done sign my name. Well, you know my name is written down in the Lamb's Book of the Lord. The blood, oh, the blood done sign my name. Now ain't you glad that the blood, well, ain't you glad that the blood, well, you know our name's been written down in the Lamb's Book of the Lord. The blood, oh, the blood done sign my name.
Wow. That's Mary D. Williams. I'm going to say amen. I think I'm allowed to say that on the air. That's Mary D. Williams. She is a performer and also a professor of African American studies at the Center of Documentary Studies at Duke University. And she is traveling with the Tyson family as they present tonight at the St. Paul School of Theology about Blood Done Sign My Name, that lyric from that spiritual, but also the title of the book that Tim Tyson has written about his family story of racial tensions and violence, in fact, in Oxford, North Carolina in 1970. Mary D. Williams, thank you for sharing that musical gift with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Mary, you have taught a class together with Tim Tyson, The South in Black and White, History, Culture, and Politics in the 20th Century South. Let me ask you, as an African-American listening to these stories, as one who studies African-American history, how does the story of the Tyson family and what they encountered in Oxford, North Carolina, accord with the broader narrative of the civil rights movement?
I think it ties deeply into our history, but I love the fact that it highlights the truth of history that's actually not sometimes written in the textbook. It's valuable information, but I love the fact that it highlights so many different parties. It highlights, you know, as far as Martin Luther King, his stance, or that the attitude of nonviolence, but it also highlights the fact of how African Americans were feeling at the time that a lot of these things were going on. It actually it does a lot for our students, not just our students in our course, but it's students when we go to high schools to hear that there were African Americans that actually did something, even though it may have been on the level of violence. And I think it is appropriate that the story has been told. And it's not so much as their story. I would have to say that. I think it's a story of so many families, African American as well as white families.
Yeah. Tim Tyson, how important is it for your white audiences to hear this story through the lens of the African-American experience?
I think, one of the things that white people tend not to hear about black rage.
Right.
They tend to hear sanitized versions that are much more clear and clean and, you know, faux redemptive, you know. There's a kind of of cheap grace, mm-hmm. As Bonhoeffer would say, in much of the stories of the civil rights movement. So we kind of leave the bark on, leave the bumps on,
yes.
and root this in – this book is really rooted in my teaching African-American history for – 12 years before I wrote this book. And so embedded in this story is the saga of what the sons and daughters of Africa endured in this country and the power of the African American culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the spirituals and gospel and the blues,
yes.
and jazz and R&B and hip hop, you know, all of this and the intellectual traditions of and style and slang and all the different ways in which the sons and daughters of Africa have, with such creativity and discipline, have confronted this these centuries of slavery and a racial caste system and making a way out of no way.
Right.
So that's
mm-hmm.
a big, you know, it's not so much our story in terms of the Tysons. You know, we are just privileged to have a front row seat and to learn what how this struggle had unfolded in the words of those who had lived through it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. To ask about that title, Blood Done Signed My Name. We've now heard the song from which it came. Why do you choose that as the title of the book?
Oh, because, you know, one, blood, of course, there's a murder at the center of this. And then, of course, there's the centuries of violence that begins in the Atlantic slave trade, that huge death machine in which millions of Africans went to the bottom of the Atlantic. You know, 14 million imported, perhaps 6 million thrown off the ships didn't make it through the Middle Passage. And that you begin with that, with the violence of underneath that undergirded slavery and segregation in this caste system. So, and that was still around really in 1970. So, and that is expressed in different ways today. But there's blood, but blood is also a metaphor we use for race.
Yes.
It is about – blood is also a word for family. When we sign our names, we are making a kind of commitment. So all of that this represents a commitment of generations of black and white Americans who are trying to make the United States Constitution and the Declaration of Independence – actually mean something. And
Tim,
so that commitment.
You had a hard time holding on to that name when you took your book up to New York City, didn't
you?
Oh,
yeah. The publishers didn't like that name. They didn't understand what it meant. They thought it sounded real black. That was it. We believe it. But anyway. In the end, I think they ended up feeling like it was actually a perfect title because there's so much of what the story is about.
There.
Well, and I'm curious if there's even another layer too in the gospel song context, that blood is redemptive blood out of the African American church tradition.
Oh, definitely.
Right. If we can't find what the crucifixion is about,
right,
is about what do you do when the world takes the best thing you have and nails it to a tree?
Yes.
You know, and so this is about, you know, for me it's been, what do we do with the tragic brutality, the multi-sided
complicated
ugliness and what we do with that? Can we make something redemptive? Mm-hmm. Can we make something meaningful? Can we make something fruitful out of this bitterness and hard history? And if we can't, you know, we're lost. But if we can, we've got so much. If we can make love and the dignity of human personality out of this kind of brutality, then we can do anything because we've got all of that history that we could possibly want. And if we can transmute that into a kind of common humanity, then we can actually get somewhere.
And take that complexity, the complexities of that to build from rather than to detract. Because the beauty of it is that that history is not brought to the attention of whether it be our students or wherever we are, our community. It is not brought to get apologies. Mm-hmm. It's not for that. It's not for anybody to.
We're not peddlers of guilt.
Exactly. But it is, it is redemptive.
Well, I guess, I want to turn around the question that you just asked and have you answer it, and maybe all of you can answer it, can in fact, it be redemptive? Are we seeing any, are you seeing any signs of redemption, of reconciliation, of a better future? Are you hopeful?
I'm hopeful, but I think I often, when I am, whether I'm by myself or with Tim, I look really heavily on the fact that information, that the truth of the history going through people, the songs and the different thing actually going through the minds and the hearts of people that we teach or the company that we're in, and having that go through them. And one of the things about our course is that the foundation of it, if we can get that information in those 300 some odd people and then just keep it going, and then next semester touch another 300 or so, and then hopefully we're going to see something come out of the wash in some years. Mm-hmm. But there are changes. But as an African-American mother, 3 African-American sons, there are a lot of changes, but then there are times when there aren't. Mm-hmm. And so, and which makes this work very important to me, because I need to allow my sons to know that the work has got to continue, and traditions, these things need to be passed on so that they, in turn, can touch their children.
Boo Tyson?
I think there's something important being a white person in this story. And the story, it's we've told ourselves a comfortable story about the civil rights movement.
Right.
And then sometimes we need to, I've learned this, to lean into our discomfort. Mm. And there's something important to validate that this was violent. This was not that Martin Luther King stood up and said, hey, folks, you know, this isn't right. And we all went, okay, and sang Kumbaya together. But this... And so there is redemption in it, but there also, I think redemption comes out of being honest about our history, and that we have in some ways whitewashed our civil rights history. And this book kind of makes people, and I think the little boy, he tells from Tim's perspective, that little boy gives people room to be discomforted and to lean into that. And I just think that's so important for healing and reconciliation. Mm. But we have to tell the truth.
And it is not the heroic, self-congratulatory white story.
No, it is not.
About how we were heroic, and you know, it's not. This ain't To Kill a Mockingbird, and Vernon is not Atticus. We're all dealing with this complicated history that we are living through. That is, we are not just the solution. We're also the problem.
Right.
And but the power of this history is the power that. I hear when I hear Mary Williams sing.
The story starts messy and it ends messy.
Yeah.
And that there's something true about that.
We all know St. Augustine, but Augustine was always a saint. Mm. He had a mother named Monica who cried over her wayward son for years, went to the priest, and finally one day, to comfort her and to get her out of his study, I think, he said, Monica, God is not going to forsake the son of these tears. So suffering love sometimes has great power in changing young adults' lives.
Yes. Yes.
this has been a very meaningful conversation, and I don't want to diminish it by this last question, but I do have to ask this. Vernon Tyson, you are the only person I've ever interviewed who has been portrayed in a movie by Rick Schroeder,
yes,
of all things. Turned into a movie, what is that like to have your life captured by Rick Schroeder?
Well, Rick Schroeder is a wonderful fella, but he didn't know a thing about baptizing a baby. I had to show him which end to baptize to start with.
And we will hold on to that image as we go today. That's the Reverend Vernon Tyson. Dr. Tim Tyson, Boo Tyson, and Mary D. Williams have joined us to talk about Blood Done, Sign My Name. They'll all be speaking or performing tonight at St. Paul School of Theology. The presentation part of the evening is free and open to the public and begins at 7 o'clock. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.